We're going to be in Esther again this morning, chapters 5 and 6 today. We're not quite going to finish the story. You'll have to come back in a few weeks for that. Next Sunday, many will be up at Camp Palmer for our Memorial Day weekend retreat. It's going to be a little bit different Sunday here. There will still be one adult Sunday school class, I believe, but all the other classes will be kind of combined into that one class. And there will still be a service here as normal, but there's going to be quite a few people who are out of town at Camp Palmer next Sunday. But Jim Carnes will be preaching the word, and so come and be blessed if you're not going to be with us there at Camp Palmer next Sunday. Today I get to speak directly to our graduates, and I know that there's no better biblical story to challenge grads with than the book of Esther. There's some really great things here in this story about a young woman, probably in her late teens, early 20s, realizing that she's been placed or maybe graduated into a position of influence, with the key phrase from chapter 4 we saw last week being that she is there for such a time as this. It's a time for young Christian women and men today who are finishing school, taking the next step in education, considering opportunities and responsibilities, to realize that you are where you are for such a time as this. It's essential that you know the time in which you live, that you understand some of the challenges that you're going to face. And I know that past generations of Christians in America may have had it relatively easy, but for you it will not be so easy, because in these times there is a clash of worldviews taking place all around us, and the Christian worldview is being marginalized and pushed to the periphery and even under attack at times. And you might ask, what is a worldview? Very good question. Maybe you never thought about the question before, but whether you've thought about it or not, you have a worldview. We all have a worldview. It's the way you understand the world around you. It's the story that you live by. It's what you believe about God. It's about what you understand to be right and wrong, about what truth is, about who you are, about why you're here. And so your worldview includes how you know, what you know, and why any of it matters. And this is being formed in you as you go to school, as you go to high school, as you go to college, and as you go into the world. And for some people, they take these questions very seriously. They're going to study this. They're going to work through these questions, and they're going to seek to arrive at solid answers and understand the importance of living and choosing and being consistent with those answers. And many others are just going to pick up the remote control and watch the final episode of Game of Thrones. Now, I've never seen the show before. I can't. I don't have a TV. I guess that has something to do with my worldview. But I've heard that it's full of some things that would be contrary to my worldview. And that settles it for me. But what concerned me this week is when I read in the newspaper that an estimated 10.5 million Americans are expected to skip work tomorrow because they're sad that their favorite TV show has ended. 10.5 million Americans, that's about the population of the state of Ohio. So you figure every man, woman, and child in Toledo, Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati, Dayton, and every town and burg from Pennsylvania to Indiana, staying home from work tomorrow because their favorite show has ended? I would call that a worldview problem. One that young people today are especially being taken up with. So if you're going to stand for a biblical worldview, you're going to swim against the stream. Instead of talking anymore about the Game of Thrones, let's go to the Bible, where we have another story about some thrones, some rulers, some power, some intrigue, some drama, and it's all presented in a way that won't stoke lustful desire or cause anyone to miss work tomorrow. How's that sound? So let's look at Esther chapter 5, and we're going to get through chapters 5 and 6 today. Last week, we were in chapters 3 and 4. We were introduced to this massive worldview conflict in ancient Persia, represented by Haman the Agagite and Mordecai the Jew. And in the middle of all this is Queen Esther. Queen Esther is beautiful, she's wealthy, she's famous. She doesn't want the responsibility, though, that she now seems to have on her shoulders. This evil prime minister named Haman has tricked the foolish King Ahasuerus into proclaiming a decree for the annihilation of all the Jews in Persia. So Mordecai, Esther's father, sends her an email saying, "You've got to help us." Esther from the palace replies, "Who, me?" And Mordecai says, "Yes, you." Esther says, you don't understand. I don't have a chance. The king doesn't really like me anymore. And he really is this guy Haman, he's got the king wrapped around his little finger." And Mordecai says, "You know what? Try anyway, because if you don't, we're all going to die. And maybe you're there for just such a time as this." So finally, Esther agrees. And she says those famous words, "If I perish, I perish." She realizes how dangerous this is, what Mordecai is asking her to do, to approach the king, to ask him to annul or somehow change this decree that has called for the execution of all the Jews in Persia that Haman has brought about. And if you were Esther, I'm sure you would be reluctant too. I mean, Ahasuerus is an unpredictable man, to say the least. This is a very dangerous thing that she's called to do. And in one of the commentaries I have from Andrew Schmutzer, he was a teacher of mine in college. He wrote this commentary on Esther, and he equates Esther's situation to that of Frodo Baggins in the Fellowship of the Ring. That when Frodo was given that ring to carry and to throw into the fires of Mount Doom, he says to Gandalf the wizard, he says, "I wish it need not have happened in my time." To which the wise old Gandalf replied, "So do I, and so do all who live to see such times. But that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us." So after weighing the consequences, Esther rises. She goes uninvited into the king's court. Chapter 5, verse 1 tells us, "On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes, and she stood in the inner court of the king's palace, in front of the king's quarters, while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace." Now, the Greek historian Herodotus tells us that there were guards on each side of Ahasuerus' throne. These guards wielded giant axes, and we're ready to chop the heads off of anyone who approached uninvited. Esther's now there, and she does not have an invitation. Verse 2 says, "And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight. And he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand, and then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter." So she passes the first test. She is not beheaded on the spot. I'm sure she lets out a deep sigh of relief as she walks slowly towards the king, but then takes in another deep breath because she knows she's got to make a very serious request. The king said to her, verse 3, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you, even to half of my kingdom." Now, Ahasuerus likes to say this. Other kings say this. It's not meant to be taken literally. If they gave away half their kingdom to everybody they offered it to, they'd be out really fast. But it's kind of like saying, "My house is your house." Doesn't mean you're handing over the deed. But he really wants to answer her request. Verse 4, "And Esther said, if I please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I've prepared for the king." It seems like Esther's stalling here, doesn't it? If she'd have just put the need out there right there, what if she just said, "You know what, I'm a Jew and the Jews are under attack and I need you to save us. Please do something now. But she doesn't. Perhaps she's hesitating. Perhaps she's afraid. Perhaps she's just following a careful strategy. But she invites the king and Haman to a banquet that she has prepared. Verse 5, then the king said, bring Haman quickly so that we may do as Esther has asked. So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. And as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, what is your wish? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even up to half my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled. Now is her opportunity. Now she's got the king really ready to receive her request. Surely she'll get it out. She'll explain her problem. She'll explain the need for her people to be delivered. Then verse 7. Then Esther answered, my wish and my request is this. Cue the suspenseful music. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and to fulfill my request, then let King Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for him tomorrow, and I will do as the king has said. Another delay. It's kind of like maybe when you've got to make a phone call you don't want to make, and you pick up the phone, and then you put it down. Then you pick it up and you dial the number and then you put it down. You ever done that? She just is having a hard time getting it out. But now there's a scene change. Verse 9. And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Haman is on top of the world. Not only is he getting his way with the king, he's now getting a special treatment from the queen. He's getting invited to all these special banquets. Everything is going well for Haman until he sees Mordecai. Still unbowing. And just that sight of Mordecai is enough to ruin his day. Now, one of my favorite sayings, my children hear me say this, Rachel hears me say this, other people hear me say this, I need to hear myself say this. People can't drive you crazy if you don't give them the keys. But that's a lot easier said than done, isn't it? Haman is giving Mordecai the keys, and Mordecai is driving him crazy. Verse 10, nevertheless, Haman restrained himself, and he went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife, Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendors of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. And then Haman said, even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. This guy's a classic narcissist. He just thinks entirely about himself and how wonderful he is and really how pathetically shallow we see him to be. But then verse 13, he says, yet all this is worth nothing to me so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. That's what's really bugging him. And he needs his wife and his friends to give him some advice. So they offer him this direction. Verse 14, his wife Zeresh and all her friends said to him, let a gallows 50 cubits high be made. And in the morning, tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast. And this idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. Now he figures Mordecai will be rid of him forever, in grand style, no less. I mean, this isn't just a hitman catching him on the street. This is going to be big. This is going to be a spectacle. The whole city is going to see this. 50 cubits, that's 75 feet high, these gallows are going to be. And this is just going to bury Mordecai in shame. If only Esther had spoken when she had the chance. Now the gallows are being constructed. It may not be soon enough to save Mordecai, now that she's waiting to the next day to see the king again. But chapter 6 brings us to the climax of the story. It's a scene change once again, now to the king's bedroom. Verse 1, on that night, the king could not sleep. He gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. Now, why can't the king sleep? Maybe it was Esther's banquet, all the rich foods he had. Maybe it was the sound of the construction workers outside his window building this giant scaffold in this giant gallows in the middle of the night. We're not told why he can't sleep. Maybe God is doing something in him. Whatever the reason, he goes to the old-fashioned remedy for insomnia, which is to read a boring book. And surely this is going to knock him out for the rest of the night. But alas, as he opens the book, he finds written there, it says verse 2, how Mordecai, this Jew, had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Remember, way back in chapter 2, a couple weeks ago, we saw this, and it was part of the introduction to the story, and it was just this detail that seemed unimportant at the time, but Mordecai uncovered a plot to kill the king, and it got recorded in the minutes of the king's board meetings, and now all these years later, he's reading it again, and he's remembering that this happened, and he feels this little prick in his conscience because he realizes he never sent a thank you note. He never said he appreciated what this guy had done for him. Verse 3, the king said, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" The king's young men who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." He had been completely forgotten. And he's trying to now decide, what should I do? This guy Mordecai, he saved my life. I never thanked him. When there's a knock on the door. Verse 4, the king said, "Who is it? Who's in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. What perfect timing. And the king's young men told him, "Haman is there standing in the court." And the king said, "Well, let him come in." Just as the king's feeling regret, having forgotten to thank Mordecai, Haman interrupts to discuss plans on how to execute Mordecai. This is getting good, but it's going to get even better. Verse 6, so Haman came in. The king said to him, "What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?" Notice he doesn't name who it is. He just says, "The man whom he delights to honor." And Haman said to himself, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" Because, of course, Haman can only think of himself. And when he starts to think about this, he's got all kinds of wonderful ideas. Haman said to the king, verse 7, "For the man whom the king delights to honor." Well, "Let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to the one the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor. Let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" I mean, Haman's figuring he gets to like now decide how he can be king for a day. Not only does he get to get rid of Mordecai, he gets to be like king. And this just looks perfect for Haman. But he's blinded by his pride and his hatred. Verse 10, then the king said to Haman, "Hurry, take the robes and the horse, just as you've said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned." Whew. Now, Haman's making an appointment to get his hearing checked. This little voice in Haman's head is saying, did the king just say what I thought he said? There's been some kind of mistake here. But that's exactly what the king said. Verse 11. I so wish there was more written here of how this all plays out. But Haman, it says, took the robes and the horse. He dressed Mordecai, led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Imagine what that would have looked like. Haman leading the king's horse around the city with Mordecai in the saddle. Haman invited, having to announce to all the crowds who have gathered that this is the man whom the king delights to honor. And maybe Mordecai says, Haman, you know, could you kind of take this parade through the Jewish quarter of Susa? Because I've got some family and friends there who I'd like to see this. And then maybe they go past the palace and they go past these giant gallows that are being constructed. And Mordecai says to Haman, what are these for? This came up overnight. Why? Verse 12. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and his friends everything that had happened to him. And then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish people, of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. Those who had just the day before had said, build the gallows, hang him high, are now singing a different song. They realize who they're up against. And then there's another knock on the door. Verse 14. While they were talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. So the story's not over yet. You're going to have to come back later to see how it ends. But some lessons for the graduates. I know we're running a little long here, but I want to take some time with this still. Because of God's justice, truth will always win, and evil will always lose. Now you say, I can't believe that, because there's too many examples in history where things did not work out like they did for Mordecai and Esther. And I have to agree that not every situation works out in just such dramatic timing. And often it seems like right is losing and evil is prospering. But remember two things. Number one, we have not yet reached the end of the story. There's still more to come. Only in the end will we see how, for all of time, truth will win and evil will lose. And number two, the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ is our promise, guaranteeing our hope and our mission. That God is at work in our world every moment of every day, in the big things, in the small things, in the details of the story. His unmistakable hand is at work. And God intervened in the world through Jesus Christ, and we have the promise that the victory has been won, that our hope is secure. So because of God's justice, truth will always win and evil will always lose. And number two, God works even as we struggle. God works even as we struggle. Esther struggled, didn't she? She dragged her feet. She was afraid. She appears timid in the midst of this. And we also will wonder if what we're doing is right. We will wonder if the risk is worth the effort. We will wonder if we've made the right choice or if the costs outweigh the benefits. And we will have doubts. We will second guess. We will hesitate and know that God will go on working, even in our failures. This gives me hope. Had Esther not hesitated, had she gone straight to the king with her request, the king would not have suffered his sleepless night. He would not have discovered what Mordecai had done. Her father would have been hung on the gallows. And Haman would not have been put to shame. So the power of God is so great that he works through us in spite of us. So don't get discouraged or give up when you fail. God's using that too. The world's going to tell you that the victory goes to the one with the best strategy, the best technique, the best method, the best skill set, the best data. But the Bible shows again and again that the victory goes to the one who stands for truth, for the one who speaks love, and the one who holds fast to what is right. That's what Jesus did for us. And finally, make Jesus Lord of your life. Make him Lord of your life. You won't hold on to a Christian worldview if Christ is not Lord of your life. You will cave to the worldview of the secular university or the TV or whatever is trending online. Know that your heart is a throne in need of a king. By nature, we make ourselves that king, but we need to turn to Jesus and to give him the throne. The worldview struggle never starts out there in the world. It always starts right in here in our own hearts. So resolve to follow Jesus in every way, every day, without reservation, or you won't stand out there. And he will give you the grace to do it. His love is real. His grace is sufficient. His forgiveness is total. He will be your strength. He will be your hope. He will be your confidence. He will be your shield. Let's pray. Father, as you were with Esther, and as you were with Mordecai, and as you were with the events of ancient Persia, we know that you are with us today. And I pray that you will especially watch over those who have graduated, who are taking those next steps, and who are facing the challenges of swimming upstream with a Christian worldview. And Lord, I pray that they will see that you are with them and that you are working in ways we cannot see, and that we can stand confident and strong in you through Jesus Christ. I pray that Christ will be Lord in each heart, that he will reign on the throne of our hearts as we live for you. Amen.